Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. I'm really thrilled to welcome today's guest. We met on Twitter, where I immediately began stalking her because she's super smart and really interesting. And then I read the first of her Under the Kilt series, which is titled Under His Kilt, and I got completely hooked on her writing. She's like my favorite author right now. So please help me welcome the ridiculously talented Melissa Blue.
Hey, Jess.
Hi. So glad we finally got to do this. I swear, every single one of these starts with me saying, thank you for putting up with our audio problems and our technical difficulties. My goal before the end of the year is to be able to say, we had no technical difficulties.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, right. I feel so professional right now, but that's all right. We all feel like imposters, don't we? Isn't that kind of the way that we work as authors?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a personality trait with all of us.
I don't know. I guess it's just like, maybe it comes from that curated view of our careers, you know, like I just see sort of the best of everyone else. And so then you're like, well,
yes.
I feel like I suck.
Yes. Yes. Because we're never afforded the view of the behind the scenes chaos. We only get the end product. That's like this perfect little thing. Cause it took me many years to realize, oh no, you can actually write. This is what everyone does.
Well, right. Cause you're comparing yourself to that end product and not the whole process. And then you're also comparing yourself to someone saying, oh, you know, I hit this list or this amazing thing happened or I have a book out, but they're not talking about that they spent 4 hours crying laying on the floor.
I kind of think
on Twitter we're more honest, though, don't you think? I mean, we're like, I one of the things I like so much about following your Twitter feed, which is Mel_the_great, if you're not following her, you totally should, is how honest you are. And that's like, I think that's a benefit of Twitter, is that people tend to be a little more honest.
I think it feels like it's a small community, and it's absolutely not, but I think that's what makes Twitter great. It feels like a small community. So it feels like you could tell the absolute truth as if you were sitting right next to someone. And on top of that, I think after a while, because we, you know, it's no longer 140 characters, but for a long while it was. So you really had to think about how you felt and make it concise. So you would be writing like a whole essay in tweet form.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that that's the great thing about, at least with Twitter. It's immediate. It's gone within, you know, 5 minutes, or used to be.
Yeah, now you're like, 3 days ago someone said this. I don't care, Twitter. I don't care. I responded to it 3 days ago.
Exactly. Exactly.
But it's true, though. I mean, there is that also that feeling of, you know, that if I say something, if I put it out there in the ether, maybe for half an hour, it'll sort of get bandied around, but then it kind of goes away. And so it's like, it doesn't feel like I said this and now it's out like on Facebook.
If I post
something, then for 5 days, people are talking about it. And it's like, sometimes you just want to throw it out there, have a conversation, be done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Trust me. I mean, I don't think I've really ever had that. Like recommendations, yes. I get recommendations. I ask for a recommendation and then I get them like for like 2 years later.
I find that creepy though. Like it doesn't creep me out as much when somebody goes back and they say something on a Facebook post that I posted 6 months ago. Because it's not too hard to flip through, but like it's hard to search through tweets. If you're retweeting a tweet that I tweeted 3 years ago, you are stalking me, like legitimately, not like,
I kind of feel that way about one that's like at least a week old. Like, it's, like, what were you doing? Like,
what is your
life? I tweet a lot, and I tweet a lot. So in a day, I can have 20 to 50 tweets. It's like, wow, I'm glad I'm that interesting, but geez.
Yeah, what is your life? What is your life that you're like flipping through my tweets from a week ago? Twitter's awesome because that's totally how I found you. I don't know how, like, I wonder the path because I'm like, I'm friends with Melissa. How did this happen?
Because I think what it is was also funny about social media is how we interact with each other. So let's say it's like 3 degrees of separation.
Yeah.
So I might have posted on like something that Bree said and you saw me and then you saw me again. And then after a while, you're like, oh my God, I don't follow her, but I see her all the time.
So
let me just follow her.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm always shocked sometimes when I don't follow someone. I'm like, but I've been commenting and chatting there for 2 years. This is my best friend. It's so true.
Yeah, exactly.
So I did go back and I did stalk you, not just on Twitter, but sort of researching. That's kind of the fun part of doing this, is I get to find out stuff because, you know
oh,
what you know.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah. So I read in your bio that you wrote your first book on a typewriter in 2004 after your son was born. And I love that you did it on a typewriter. That made me happy. The typewriter's the best. That sound is the best.
So it really did. It gave me such joy.
Yeah, because it feels so productive when you hear
it
that
does.
Clack, 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 clack.
And ding! And when it goes to the
ding.
Next line, yes.
Oh, like heaven. I like it. Like I have kind of a clacky keyboard on my computer, and I'm like, that's the closest that I can get to that.
Yeah, yeah. I love that sound too.
That click, click, click. So what made that the moment? I know you said that you were watching Oprah's, was it her,
her dream season.
Yeah,
everybody remembers it as the season where she gave away all the cars, which is like iconic now.
Right.
But
you get a card.
Yeah, I mean, it's been spoofed. It's what people say, like just a joke about, you know, any kind of giveaway.
Right.
And so... Also, during that episode, she gave this girl, like, she had been homeless. I mean, her life had been seriously, seriously rough. And all she wanted was to go to college to have a better life.
Yeah.
And Oprah pretty much gave her the stars and the moon, way more than what she was asking for. And I just thought to myself, my dream is to write. I don't need Oprah to give me that. All I have to do literally is sit down and write. And I haven't stopped since.
That's super powerful. Like feeling that moment where it's like, this isn't me. I don't need anybody to help me do that.
Yeah. And you know, I was a single mom and broke, and like all I could afford was a typewriter. And literally the first thing I wrote on, it was just like a college line piece of paper, because I didn't even have like
printer paper type.
I didn't even have printer. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, those pages are somewhere. I will never show them to anyone.
But that's never. I know. I mean, I think you learn by writing, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, you wrote,
you
and then
do.
You learned how to write, and then when you take a class or something, you can apply that to what you've written. But I think that you learn so much just from writing.
Yes. Yes. Because I started writing, you know, and I want to say maybe about it was a couple of months later, because my mother got me a computer for Christmas. So I started in August. So by December, I had my computer, and I got online to Harlequin, because that was like the only publisher that I knew. And I'm like, they're romance, and they had forums. And then people start talking about how to write books, and I fell down that rabbit hole.
It is a rabbit hole.
It is, especially when you're new and you feel like you must not be doing it right. There has to be some sort of guidebook to find out how to do this better. And I, that first 2 years, I studied, read everything under the sun about how to write. And I'm grateful I did it, but good God, the best thing to write is to write.
I agree. Well, because you can get so confused.
Yes.
Because especially since there's really great people that are giving advice, and there's people that are, they probably mean well, but they're not giving the best advice. Like they're saying you always have to do this, or you should do this. I always shy away from that immediately. Because the way that I write, if I tell you about it, you might go, oh, that's interesting. I want to try that thing that you're talking about.
Yes.
But I would never tell you the way I write is the way that you should write, because that's crazy pants. Vice versa. I mean, if you tell me this is how I write, which we're going to talk about in a little while, and I go, oh, that's really interesting. I want to try that. Like, that's great. That's writers helping writers. But if I tell you that's how you have to write, then I've lost the thread.
Yes. And I think that was the big thing I had learned from all those how-to books and just sucking up all the information I can about character, structure, hell, how to format something, was a whole lot of people gave out absolutes.
Yeah.
And that doesn't help. Because for me, what I had to get to was get to a point, do whatever helps. If writing out of order is your jam, do it. Don't ever stop. I personally can't do it. It would drive me insane, and I would never, ever finish a book. But I would tell someone else they shouldn't do it, because that might work. That may be the way they can get from a two-page idea to a novel.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, if it's working for you, you should do it. When it stops working for you, try something different. Is kind of that's basically, you never have to take a class from me now. That's every class I've ever taught.
Welcome to my TED Talk.
Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. And Melissa's TED Talk. It's a two for TED Talk. So I assume you had been reading romance before that, though, right? You were reading it.
Yeah. When did you start? I really started in 2002, 2003. I had my heart broken and I was like totally depressed. And it was a DAV store. I can't remember. It's like a veterans thrift store.
Okay.
And they had books for like 5 cents, 10 cents. And, you know, my first love definitely was murder mystery. But it was like, that was just too gloomy for me. And they had all these romance books and I would literally buy them by the droves. Like, I mean, a book, I can get 10 books, if not more.
Yeah.
And Harlequins, I could read those like 2 to 3 in a day. And that's really what got me started, is that, the books made me feel better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the crowning glory of romance. It is. The point.
It really is. They made me feel better. And I absolutely needed that, because I had just graduated and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. My heart is broken and everything sucks. And they really just gave me hope.
Yeah. So, it's kind of interesting that you say that you came to romance late, because every single person I've talked to for this podcast up until this point, including me, has come to romance late. And I always felt like that it's kind of something that's sort of a teaching moment for me, because I always thought, well, I came to romance really late, but everyone else started reading it, you know, out of the womb and started books. And apparently this is not true. So we're just busting.
No, like my mother, she was a big reader, because her mother was a big reader. But again, murder mysteries, that was her jam. I want to say she did have Fallen Angel by Frances Ray. Sandra Brown, Sunset Embrace. Those are like my two very, very first ones. But I'm not even sure if those were her copies or if they were my sister's. But at the same time, it's like, but I really didn't fall in love until I was about 18, 19, around there.
So did you consider writing murder mystery, since that was sort of what you cut your teeth on as a reader, or was it straight to romance that you went?
When I first wrote, it was romantic suspense. So it was a marriage of the two that I started writing. And then I did research on, 'cause at the time, what was really, really big was writing from the villain's point of view and romantic suspense. And so I picked up some books on like the psychology of serial killers. And there was one where he went through like the range of criminals, from petty theft to serial killer. And after I read that book, I couldn't sleep for 2 days straight. And I was like, maybe this is not my jam. This may not be for me, because now I have to get into their head and write people like that. I mean, it was just, no.
That's not going to make you feel better.
Absolutely not.
So are you like a big, like a investigation discovery or like, you know, murder show person still? Or?
Oh my God. Yes.
Oh my God. All right. That's another podcast.
Like my children know, if it's British and it's a mystery, I'm going to want to watch it. I mean, that's all I need.
Yeah. I'm really into like the true crime, like Snapped and all that. We'll get together. We'll talk. Another time. This isn't a journey of romance. This is a journey of people who like murder, which is another podcast entirely.
All together, yes.
Yeah, just put it all together. It's going to be great. One thing I found really interesting when I was kind of going back and I was stalking your blog was that at some point recently, not in the beginning, you retired, I think is how you put it, some of your older books. So
yes.
Because they were sweet, right? So you started out publishing, even if that's not what you started out writing, you started out publishing sweet romances. Yes. Is that correct?
Yes, that is very correct.
Was that under the Melissa Blue name?
Yes. Yes.
And so I mean, I just found that very interesting just because what you write now is so entirely the opposite of that. And there's a place for both, but it's just, you don't hear a lot about people like starting out writing super sweet romance and then writing like super hardcore amazing hot romance.
Writing borderline erotica. Yes. And I think what it was is when I started writing, I was really, really young and I just wasn't comfortable with not necessarily my own sexuality, but writing it and then giving it to other people to read. So I think I was more than capable of writing it. I just didn't feel like I could write that and ever, you know, let anyone.
You would
read
know
it.
People were reading it. And that was yes. uncomfortable.
It was way too uncomfortable. But it's like, it was funny because it was like a slow sort of immersion into filth.
Yeah. You just dipped your toe in and then slid right to the deep end of the pool.
and what's funny, every single one of my writer friends, they wrote erotic. They wrote BDSM. And here I am just writing, you know, kind of tepid, steamy kind of books. And they would always say, Melissa, no, you should write filth. And I'm like, no, not me. Clutch my pearls. And so then when I finally did, they were also very proud of me. And they're like, we knew it all along.
We knew your heart. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I mean,
so did you think about traditional publishing at that point with the sweeter books when you started? Was that your original goal? Or, I mean, obviously 2004 when you started writing. And again, the difficulty since things got retired, I'm not sure what year you were first published.
So I was first published in 2008, I want to say.
So sort of pre the indie revolution.
Very much so. Very, very much so. I mean, people were still going, what's an ebook when
right.
I first published with Wild Rose Press. And the book was, it was sweet-ish. I thought it was like the hottest thing I had ever written. God bless me. and so that was like what that was kind of like my road, my groove, you know. Write banter, write a charming hero who's slightly better, and it really is just a sweet romance. And so my goal, obviously, was traditional publishing. But the problem was I wrote too short.
Right.
Right? Because it took me a long while to write anything over 50,000 words. And so there was no avenue back then.
Yeah, like, maybe some of the Harlequins might have been a little bit close to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of choice
yeah.
for a short
so
book.
Yeah, so me writing a 20,000 word or 30,000 word book, there was really no other path for me to go but e-publishing because they would right. publish that. And limited people would publish that because they really didn't like selling novellas. And so, I mean, and that's like this space I was stuck in for so many years because I just write short. Even now, I still write short. But I go in and edit, and then that's when things start to blow. But yeah, I didn't have that skill set yet. So traditional publishing was out because I just couldn't write long.
So you went to Wild Rose, which is a smaller press, EPUB. Which
yep.
yeah, I mean, it's funny. Back in 2008. When I was writing for HarperCollins, and they weren't even doing ebooks of their books yet.
Yeah, it took them
it's
a while.
It's crazy.
It was
like 2011 while. When they yeah. were like, oh, we should have ebooks. I'm like, are you on crack? Like, what's happening right now? How do you not understand?
Yeah, EC
That's
is
another
out,
story.
Yeah, EC was out there making authors millionaires, and they
yes.
were still saying, oh, I don't know about this ebook thing. Are you serious?
Don't worry about your Amazon ranking. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, well, my editor, Nancy Swanson, she took such a huge risk on me, even, you know, with Rob Roll Press. It I don't think it was ever on the same level as Samhain or EC. But she saw something in my first book. Well, first book that, you know, was published, cause it was actually my third book. But she saw, and I'm telling you, there's no way in hell that an editor now would have done what she done for me.
So she really dug in with you and yes. kind of helped you with your craft.
Yes, yes. Like, I literally didn't know the difference between it and, you know, possessive it and breast. Couldn't spell that to save my life. and she just really nurtured me as an author. And I simply can't thank her enough for that.
See, and that's amazing. I mean, I believe in the idea that things happen, things work out, I guess. I don't necessarily if I believe in destiny, but I do believe that yeah. things tend to work out. And so it's like you found that space, and that's the space clearly that you were meant to be in because it helped you develop.
Yes, 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 yes. So I definitely appreciate really it was like almost like a mentorship that I have with my editor. Because all the things that, you know, people say they love about me now was there in that first book. And she saw it.
Right. She saw your voice. Yeah. Which your voice, you have an amazing voice.
And so, thank you.
You know, I mean, obviously she saw that and knew that it was worth yeah. the work.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
Yes.
Because you're right. I mean, I don't know that you would have had that in a more traditional publishing house.
I wouldn't have that with a critique partner. Right. So yeah, she really helped me. And, you know, I'm not sure she would ever read my books now because she totally is sweet as my jam. I don't yeah, I don't read her.
So when you went to the dark side, she was like, no, wait.
Where are you going, Melissa?
Please come back. So what was the catalyst of that? What took you from, it looked like it was 6 or 7 books, something in there that were sweet. And then you kind of transitioned. What was the catalyst of that transition to something hotter?
I think because I was just reading more erotic books and it started to become harder to use, you know, like Lady Garden, his sword and like, just say cock, damn it, say cock.
Yes.
and then I think that's where it kind of evolved for me. And the one book, it's not published now, that really was like really the tipping point for me was, Everything He Dreamed. And it was like a second book in a series that I had that it was magical realism, a contemporary author writing magical realism in a one-off series. And that's how it ended up unpublished because that's right. just weird. But
you have no space. There's no genre for that.
No, not really. And I really went there in that book and I was like, oh my God, this is fun. And the response I got back, it kind of confirmed that muting my voice was keeping me from reaching my readership. Because that's what I had been doing all this time. I've been tamping down, saying, letting the hero say fuck, having the heroine say shit. And I really just kind of relaxed and let loose in that book. And the response back convinced me, this is the road you need to go to. Because you're actually reaching readers when you're letting yourself come out on the page.
Yeah. No, it's when they hear your... when it's genuine, they
yes.
know.
Yes.
It's the same reason why, you know, when you chase around writing different genres that you're not really passionate about, I think it doesn't really work.
Yes. Well, you know, I wouldn't even say genres because there's a back way to get into whatever genre it is, and that's finding the themes that really call to you. And then that's the way in.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. That's really true. Because we're not really writing about genres, we're writing about emotions in a romance.
Yes.
And so I can write that anywhere as long as I'm not an idiot and don't like figure out how to actually do it. But, you know,
yeah.
I mean, people are always like, I don't know how to write Regency. I'm like, yeah, you do. You just don't know the research.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And it's kind of the same thing. So I have to gush about Under the Kilt series again because I flipping love these books. So I've read the first three now. I bought the rest. They're on my reading. We're actually going to Scotland next week. So,
oh, my God.
I know.
I'm so excited.
I'll take lots of pictures. If I see any really cute Scots, I will take pictures of them for you. Not creepy at all. It's totally fine.
Totally fun.
So I'm going to be finishing out that series probably while I'm on the flight over and flight back. So those books, though, they really took off, didn't they? I mean, it seemed like they really sort of were a turning point for you in your career.
And what's so funny is that it was a happy accident. It was really just a happy accident because I love England. I love everything about it. And I'm like, I really want to write an English hero because I loved Spike so much that I literally wanted to write a hero who said love and pet. And like, that was my focus for, that's what Under His Kilt was supposed to be. But I didn't have any English people around me who could like vet the language, vet some of the slang, but I had a Scottish critique partner and she was like, just make them Scottish, I'll help you out. And I said, okay, sure, let's go with it. And that is how the series started.
Oh, that's so funny. So it was really just your sensitivity reader.
Pretty much. Like, I'm like, I would need someone to vet my language so yeah. I'm not having, you know, my English hero sounding like an American.
Right.
And she was like, well, I write the story and I'll vet the language for you. And it was like, I know I wanted to write Her Insatiable Scott. But like
that's the one I just finished.
Yeah. Yeah. So those were the only two books I had planned. And I was like, yeah, we'll see how this goes. I mean, because who writes a modern day Scott? There's not a lot of people. There's more people now. But when I wrote it, I was very aware that I had to market it so people understood it was contemporary. Because when you hear Scott, you think historical.
Right.
And it was gonna, I knew it was gonna be interracial, and that was still, you know, really only Black women were like the huge fan base. They still are the huge fan base of it, but like not a whole lot of other people read it. So when I released it, I was really shocked how much people liked it, how much people loved it. I'm like, really? That's the filthiest thing I've ever written, and you guys love that?
And that must have been a big, like, yes, these are my people. This is where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah, because that, what's funny is, like, I had written Weekend Lover, which was my first official erotic romance, in that whole series. But I was like, you know what? I went dirty there, but I want Under His Kilt to be the filthiest thing I have ever written in my life. And that's why it has 16 million sex scenes, because that was like the legit goal. Make it filth, make them Scottish. Boom.
Well, you have succeeded in that, both arenas. So what do you think was the reason that it took off so much? I mean, aside from the fact that they're fantastic books, like, do you think it was because you were writing something that was just different enough that it sort of piques people's interest?
Yes,
or?
Absolutely. I absolutely think that's the reason. It was, I want to say it was probably really, really refreshing. Like, oh, a modern day Scott? I haven't read a lot of books like that. Let me check it out. And I think that was a big thing. And plus, at the time, it was in like the boom era of indie publishing, and finally African American women were getting books that featured them, that sounded like them, that had their families, and they went out and bought it because they were that a Scottish hero. Oh, I love a man with accents. And they really pushed it so that finally people who only really read in the mainstream, or people who were really, you know, finally checking out indie books, noticed me. And so I am forever grateful to that book.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book. I mean, that doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
they've stumbled upon something and then it's really well done, you know, really helps. And I think that that's an interesting point, that traditional publishing, and I mean, you talk about this a lot, and obviously it's sort of in the Twitter air all the time, but especially right now, is that traditional publishing has sort of failed in its diversity in general. It failed. But especially in the way that it markets books that are written by Black women, mm-hmm. or written by people of color, or written about, you know, LGBTQ, it doesn't know what to do. And so, I mean, it's one of those things that when books were just in bookstores and I went into Barnes & Noble in romance, I didn't see books by Black women. They were over in the
African-American
fiction section. And so it separated off in a way that really makes zero sense. But versus, you know, in indie publishing, people were just, you know, you're just putting in romance where it belongs.
Yep.
It's a great book because it's a great book. And do you think that that's the key, is that it's not, like, acknowledging that it's, your book is written by a Black woman, it features a Black heroine, that's something that, you know, you don't want to not say is true, but at the same time, like, it's a romance. It's just a really good freaking book. Go buy it because it's a great romance. It doesn't need to be separated off into its own section. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
And see, I think I may be the only last holdout, but let me set up my reasoning. Yes. And brick and mortar stores, in libraries, separating Black African American books or LGBTQ books into another section is insane. It is stupid. It needs to go away. In a digital era, when you can shelve a book in several places at once. Right. To me, it makes sense to make it easier for a Black woman who's only looking for books written by a Black author to find a Black author within, you know, whatever genre choice she wants to read, while also that book is being able to be found by people more in the mainstream. And to me, it's like, I still shelve my books in IR, but they're also in contemporary, because that just makes sense to me, because they're both.
Right, and I think that's a really good point, is that now you shelf, I mean, you put in your keywords or your categories, and you can say, you could put it in African-American fiction or interracial romance, and then someone that was specifically looking for that thing could find it, but it should just go in contemporary romance, it should go in Scottish romance, it should go, I mean, it belongs in a lot more categories, and when you limit that category choice, you're limiting someone finding it that's just going to love it.
Yeah.
It's a great book.
They're like, I believe in letting readers find their exact catnip.
Yes, I agree.
Do not make it hard for them to search for it at all.
So I think one of the really most interesting things in talking to the other indie authors who I've talked to during the podcast is how fluid we can be in change. Mm-hmm. And we've sort of already started talking about that, because you wrote Sweet Stuff. You've written under a different name too, right?
Yeah, Dakota Gray. And before that, it was Sophia Harper.
What was the difference in the stories for those? Or was there?
There was none.
You're just feeling it out.
No, what happened was, I had it in my head. You know what? The Melissa Blue name. And this is what's so ironic and funny. So I wrote as Melissa Blue originally. Failed so very horribly. I want to say I maybe sold 50 books for the length they were, for the time they were published, and that was like over 2 years. And I was like, that name is dead. I'll never make any money under Melissa Blue. Let me rebrand myself as Sophia Harper. She writes semi-sweet romances, you know, that are, you know, tropey. And so that was the distinction I made for myself. Like, I was retiring the Melissa Blue name. And then the self-publishing revolution started, and I started to think, okay, well, you know, Sophia Harp really doesn't have any books published. There's, you know, a lot to brand with that. And Melissa Blue is already kind of established. If nothing happens, it doesn't matter, because, you know, it's a dead name anyway. And funny enough, you know, nobody knows who Sophia Harper is.
Right.
So yeah, that's really how it started. I thought I was going to rebrand myself and find better success. No.
Yeah. Well, in the end, you have to start from the bottom. You have to start rebuilding from scratch. That's really difficult too. But it is interesting that back in the day, back when I started, you know, almost 10 years before, like, you couldn't, if your name died, you were dead and you really had to start over.
Yes.
And that doesn't exist now.
Yes. Yes. There
is. I mean, if I have a book that failed, I can rebrand it. I can retitle it. I can change the cover. I can do a special sale on it. There's no failure in baseball.
Anymore. Yeah. Now there's no more dead books. There are books that may not have as wide as a market as you believe it has, but there are no more dead books, because a book that didn't hit in 2012 can become someone's bestseller in 2008.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely true. I mean, I guess that's part of the fluidity, you know, is that we can change, we can shift, we can adjust, not just the way we write or who we write as or who we're writing for, but how we're publishing and how we're promoting.
Yes.
You know, you can come back, I could pluck a book out of my backlist, you could pluck a book out of your backlist, and you could give it a fresh life. I mean, there is a limit, because there's a timeout on who, you know, if there's 10,000 people that want to read a book like yours, and those 10,000 people eventually buy it, then you probably, like, you're not going to get a lot more out of that. But, I mean, assuming, but you still could, because you could say, okay, well, what about this element of this book? That might have 10,000 more people. So there's always, and I feel like that's another place that traditional publishers haven't really caught up the same way.
No.
You know, there's still, a book comes out, it has a month, and then they're on to the next thing, and they're never looking back.
Yep.
And I actually think that's one of the failures within that system, is that they haven't caught on to that doesn't exist anymore.
Yes. Yes. I want to say they're the smaller imprints have caught on, but it's not necessarily they caught on. The authors they've taken on are the ones who are advocating for their dead books. And giving them ideas, giving them suggestions, talking to the publicity team about what can be done. And
you've got a savvier set of authors who are more active and proactive in the way that they're dealing with a publisher versus
And when I started, it was like your publisher marketed your book. That was the belief, was that your publisher did it. If your publisher didn't do it, then they didn't believe in you, and that was that. There was nothing you could really do. And that's so not the truth now. An author can honestly be the best advocate for their book, and they should be.
Well, no one loves it as much as you do.
Not exactly.
No one cares about your success as much as you do, because you're the one, you know, in theory, potentially paying your bills. And also, I mean, you're the one that loves it. You know, I mean, I can't imagine writing a story that I didn't love. So, you know, I mean, I don't know if you feel this way when people say, what's your favorite book that you've written? I'm like, I don't know. Really, children, what are you doing? Why?
There are books that I end up hating. So, but I think that's like a slight semantic thing. It's like, I love the book when I first started writing it, but after the 10th revision,
that's true. I remember this really funny story about, someone that wrote Regency like I do. And they said, by the time they'd gone through their fifth or sixth edit, they edited in, and then they opened up the carriage door, stepped out, were hit by a bus.
Well, yeah, I think I saw that. Yeah.
That is me. Like, you know what? We're done.
I don't care about your happily ever after. Apparently
you don't even deserve one. You're a bunch of jerks. But I think I do. I mean, you know,
I know what you mean.
There's
I know
periods in the process where I'm like, I hate you all. But in the end, when I look at it, like, you've made a thing. Like, it's like a thing that you made, and it's...
But my memory sucks. It's like, after I've released the book, I kind of forget it. So
me too.
My favorite book is always the one I'm currently writing, in a sense.
We are the most invested in it, too.
Yeah. Because, you know, what's funny is, like, when I was preparing to re-release the Gridiron Bad Boy, I had to reread it, try to catch any errors that I missed before, pull out any quotes so I can make graphics. And I was like, oh my God, I really like this book. How did I forget I wrote this?
And don't you think that
that's so
it's
bad.
The distance between
it is,
you know, because it's like I have a book in my head and that's perfect, and then I have a book on the page, not perfect, and then after I take a really long time away from it and I look at it again, then it's just a book because I'm not invested in it the same way.
Yes.
I mean, that's the best thing I can do for myself with editing is take the longest amount of time. But that's not the way that indie publishing works.
No.
that's the disadvantage. So the Gridiron, that's the newest one that just came out, right?
Yeah,
so
that's
a re-release?
It's a re-release. It was originally in Bella Andre's Game for Love Kinderworld, and that's pretty much where any author who has the time can like write within the world, you know. And I decided to do one. Kindle World is no more, and they gave me back the rights to it, and I can publish it, and it will be wide. I could put it anywhere because before they only had the U.S. rights, and so that's why I put it back out, because then I read and I'm like, oh my God, I actually like this book again. And I'm like, you know, and I know a whole lot of readers did want it, but they either didn't have Kindle, didn't want to buy on Kindle, and so I just re-released that so, you know, people can enjoy it for themselves.
Are you going to expand that into a longer series?
I think I'm only going to write one more book in it. And that will be that. Because, I mean, it's the novella series.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard now. You know, it used to be, you know, I could only write short. Now it's really tough for me to get something under 30,000 words.
Sure.
And so I think I'm only going to do one more book because it's going to take forever to write it short. So, yeah.
Got it. Well, so do you think that the fluidity of what we can and are willing to do is helpful, or do you sometimes feel like you're chasing your tail because it's like, oh, I could do this, but I could do anything? Like, that's the worst thing in the world you can tell me. Like, you can do anything. And I'm like, please just give me two choices.
You know what? I have found, I want to say I have found a somewhat good balance. And that's why I have like two pen names that people know of, is that I can do anything, but sometimes I'm in a mood for something very specific. So if I'm feeling in a light, bubbly, bantery mood, I'm going to write a Scott book. If I'm feeling, you know, a little more on the darker edge of things, I can write a geek book. If I just want to write utter filth that is kind of sweet, I can write under my Dakota name. And depending on the series, I'll know how long it is. And it really comes down to what am I in the mood for? And the fun part is because I self-publish, if I want to start a new mood writing, I can do it. I can create another series.
So you think it's really about your creativity then, what you're in the mood for.
Yes.
And, you know, there's an audience for what you're in the mood
yes.
for out there somewhere.
Yeah, because I have learned the hard way. Writing against my mood is always a bad decision. It always is an utter disaster. But I think that comes with experience. I didn't know that about myself before. And so I would feel like a failure because I couldn't finish a book that I had started that, you know, it's a good book, nothing wrong with it. It's just, I didn't realize I was just not in the mood to write it.
See, I love that. I love that as we go along, we learn, you know, I mean, you hear process and you think, how often do you write? How many pages or words
yeah,
you write a day? Where
yeah,
you
yeah.
write, if you write at night or in the morning. But really, it's about the process of how you are emotionally connecting and what you
yes.
know works and doesn't work
yes.
for you. Shayna Galen, when I was speaking to her, she's a real pantser, like a legitimate pantser. Like, has no, and I'm like, oh my God, it's so stressful. But I said, how do you keep from writing yourself into corners? And she's like, because I've done it so many times, I know how to not do it. And I'm like,
oh. And it's
my
true.
God, you're brilliant. Because it hadn't yeah. occurred to me as a plotter, you know. So
yeah.
I love that the authors that I think are successful and that have longevity, we do figure out process beyond what process looks like from the outside.
Yes. I mean, we kind of figure out what works, what doesn't work, and to realize when something's not working to do something else. And I think that's hard to do because I know for me as a new writer, I so identified with, you know, what I was doing right then and there. I honestly thought it was always going to be just like that. And so whenever I would stumble, I wouldn't know what to do. I would
feel like it was a failure, a failure of you, and not a failure of the process.
Yes, I couldn't think on my feet because this is my process. This is the genre I write. This is whatever X, and this is the only thing you can do. I wrote a whole lot of stone tablets that I really didn't need to.
I love that way of putting it.
Yeah, I put it in stone. It must be. And I just kind of just learned to get away from that.
So that actually leads me really well into talking about process. So recently you said on Twitter, I told you I stalked you, that I was already stalking you, but then I was like, ooh, that's interesting. And I was like writing it down, that you were trying to write a novella in like 8 days. And I was like, you go, girl, do it. Because I'm a fast writer. So are you generally a fast writer?
You know, it's funny. I used to be. Because I would do nano and then I'd be done after 2 weeks and everybody else would be like, oh my God, Melissa, how did you do it? And it's like, I rarely slept. I really didn't eat. I just wrote and really just dialed into the story. I mean, and that's when I can write fast, is when I know exactly what's going to happen. It's right there in my head. I just have to write to it. And yeah, I could, like, back in the day, like if my head wasn't so caught up in another book, I could have written a novella in 8 days. But yeah, that didn't happen.
Because you had other voices going on in there.
Yeah, there's another story that is all I can think about. Like, oh, I need to get back to it and write this. I need to get back to it and fix this and layer that in. And that's literally just what just stays in my mind. And there's nothing else that could fill it until it's like a compulsion. Mm-hmm. Until it's out of my system, I won't be able to do anything else.
Yeah. No, I actually feel the same way. It's like if I just write it, which I think is the thing that people don't understand about people that write quickly, is that it's Michelangelo used to say that, like, the thing is already in the marble and he's just getting it out.
Yes.
And I feel like that's really the truth.
Yes.
Like,
it's already there.
I just need to write it down. And so it's not about, like, I don't know, like cranking it out or whatever, you know, people say when they want to talk about that writing fast sucks, but it's that it's already there. And I need to get it out.
Yes.
It just needs to get out.
I mean, and what's funny is, like, you know, and again, that's kind of how I learned what my process was, is that I was able to write fast because even if I didn't write down the structure, the three acts, if I didn't write anything down, it was all already in my head and I knew what was going to happen. I knew what to write next and to trust that. And that was the hardest thing, and to trust that to happen.
So you're a plotter then, it sounds like, at least in that you know what it's going to be in your head. Do you write it down?
It depends. Like if it's like, sometimes I feel like something that's not working is almost like on the tip of my tongue, I'll write it out. I'll write it out. What am I thinking in my head? Let me put it down on paper. And there's something about physically writing it out for things to become clearer for me. And that's when I do it. When it's not working, that's when I do my hardcore plotting. When it's working, I will pants my way to the end.
Because it's really in your head, though.
I mean, yeah.
It kind of sounds like it's plotted in your head. You just have a way to organize it in your brain that doesn't need to be written down unless it's struggling.
Yeah, because I wrote Perv. I would have to look. I wrote Perv in like two and a half weeks.
Wow.
But the thing is, I had been thinking about the plot for like a year because I kept telling people the joke. I'm totally going to write about a man who's obsessed with, you know, Fellatio, Flashio, however it's pronounced. And I'm going to call it Sugar Walls. And I kept telling that joke for like a year. So then when it finally came down for me to sit down and write it, that's why it was sort of easy for me to sit down and write in 2.5 weeks. Because I had been literally plotting it for a year.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's sitting there cooking in your head.
Yeah.
And then you get there. And it's like, I already know what I want to do.
Yep.
Yeah. Yay, my process is very similar. So that's what I love, though, is, again, I think that comes with experience, knowing what you need to do and not saying, well, I have to write it down or I have to not write it down to be able to have it be successful.
Yeah, and I think that's how I kind of figured out traditional publishing wasn't for me, is you have to write that one book.
Right.
It's on contract, on deadline. You're going to have to turn it in. You're going to have to edit that one book, even though you've moved on to something else. Oh my God, it's horrible.
No, it's true that it's so much more structured.
Yes.
And the whole system of it is structured from the beginning to the end, that it doesn't work with someone who's a more fluid writer. And again, you think, it makes me wonder, back in the days where there was no other option, how many people who were amazing writers
just do it,
just, you know, in their minds failed,
yeah,
and then stopped,
yeah,
because there was no place, that they didn't belong in this space.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you think about it that way, it's like, that's really heartbreaking. And also so exciting that doesn't have to be now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there is a space for anyone in this environment, and it's just finding that space. I mean, not that there aren't challenges.
One story I remember, because the last time I went to RWA was like 2009, I want to say. But Nora Roberts was talking about like some of her earlier process, is that because she's a panster, but she was supposed to give her editor a synopsis. And so what she would do is that she would write the book and then give her editor synopsis. So there were ways
back. So much extra work.
Oh my God. Yes. Especially if the editor is like, this doesn't work, you're going to have to rewrite it. Now the book is done and you're going to have to gut it. But at the same time, I'm sure there was ways to get around it. But yeah, I know, especially if someone's a new author, how hard it is to be able to trust in yourself. So yeah, I can't, apparently I'm not capable of doing this. I'm going to go, you know, collect bottle caps or whatever and just give up on writing.
Because it is a very, I mean, the process of creating a story, I enjoy it. I know a lot of people don't actually enjoy it, but, which I think it makes me sad, but, it is a difficult job. It's emotionally taxing. It's actually physically taxing to write a book. And then you add the and the writing is always great for me, but the publishing is what is horrifying. If I could just like magically snap my fingers and have it just work, I would love that. But, and I would market that.
Who wouldn't?
And I would make so much money. I'd be a billionaire. But I mean, you know, when you add onto that no choice but this one thing, I mean, I think that probably makes it a lot harder. So it's a good
really
time
does.
to be a published author, to be an author, I think, with the options.
Yeah.
So what's your process when you're done with the book? I noted that you did a blog series on making your own covers. Do you still do that, or are you
using... I still, I'm such a control freak. I still make my own covers. I still make my own graphics. Because in a sense, it's like, I know what I want in my head, and it's kind of hard to tell somebody else what I want. And I think I know I would be a nightmare for a cover artist, because I would make them change so much, because I part of my process when I make a cover is that I tweak and move things around until there's a moment where I go, oh my God, this is amazing, this is perfect, don't touch it, or oh my God, I'm tired of this shit, I'm done.
Sure.
But you really can't do that, you know, to a cover artist that's cruel. So that's why I still do it myself.
You seem like you're really good at it, because your covers are amazing and they look professional.
Thank you. I don't know
if you could recommend that to other people, although I mean, I'm sure it's just like everything else. It's a trial and error.
Oh my God, yes. The learning curve to and here's the thing about me. I'm not really a crafty person, but I try to be. I'm not really, outside of like writing and graphics or before I started having me to do my own covers, I thought I couldn't creatively create like art. I can draw stick figures. That's the best I can do. Like I'm Picasso, but on accident. So just keep that in mind. I decided to be creatively do covers. My first covers were horrendous and horrible, and I'm so sorry to my fans who have been with me since 2012, and God, it was horrible. But it really was just a learning curve, and it still is learning how to do art, looking at what's new as far as what's coming out of, you know, what bestseller covers look like right now. It's just like writing, it's an ever-changing market. But I find it interesting, and I like doing it, and I wouldn't recommend it if that's not something that you love or might think you might love. Just hire out, honestly.
Right. Well, I always tell my husband, like, creativity is only in one place. he claims that's not true, but he doesn't know.
he's an unreliable source. He loves you.
Yes. He's biased.
Totally biased.
I'm not good at art, but no, but it's, I mean, I think that that's the thing is, we tell ourselves so often, like, well, I'm not good at that, because we're not good at it immediately.
Yes. Oh, my God. The more that you play with it. That's the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, I know that I'm better at graphics than I was when I first started. I do the custom photo shoots with Jen LeBlanc, and she gives me all these images, and I make these memes. And my first memes, I'm like, oh, baby memes. So bad at it. And now I'm like, hey, I'm getting pretty good at this. Like, I'm okay. So
yeah,
I do think they're, you know, but it's so easy for us to say, I don't know. And I think that that's the difference, again, between writers who keep going and writers that quit, is it's like, I'm bad at this. Well, yes, of course you are. You're new. You're going to get better, but it's that ability to say, I'm going to keep, like you said, learning what my process is, learning what works for me.
Yeah, and what I found funny is that I can't remember what started it, but someone was like, how often a lot of us are, you know, writers were like those gifted children growing up, and how now as adults, it's easiest for us to quit because we don't get it right the first time, because mm-hmm. we were so ingrained at being gifted that, you know, you do it once, you're amazing at it. And it's so hard for us to go, no, we're not amazing at it. You got to keep learning and learning and learning. And it's harder for us to do that now as adults. And I was like, yeah, I found that interesting, because that's what keeps me being a writer, is because I'm trying to get it right and perfect. Like, that's my drive. I'm trying to write the best story ever to ever be written, or that I could be possibly of writing. And I fail, so I must try again.
Well, and it's the tightrope, too, of, like, I want it to be perfect, but I also know that if I wait for it to be perfect, it'll never come out.
Oh, so yes.
It's like yes. the acceptance of it can't be perfect.
Yes.
Combined with the needing it to be perfect. I mean, we're a neurotic bunch.
Oh, so neurotic.
So you work full-time still, right?
Yes.
And you have kids.
Yes.
How do you juggle everything? I have so much respect for that.
Lack of sleep.
Well, okay, no. Okay, there's the answer.
There's the answer. If you want to be successful, go without sleep for 4 years.
Don't sleep. That's actually not that far off the mark.
Right? I think right now it really is tough for me. Because, like I said, when I get to a stage where I'm, like, compulsive about a story, like, that's, I can't function. I can't focus on anything else. So that really is very tough for me to do, because I have to put, like, the story on hold until I get home. And then sometimes it's not even when I get home, because my kids need me. So a lot of it is just stealing the time, or, you know, but I'm lucky in regard that my children are older. They're not toddlers. I have teenagers. So I could tell them, dear God, leave me alone.
And they're probably like, score, leave me alone too. Everybody's happy.
No, my kids, the only way for me to get my kids to spend time with me is me telling them to leave me alone. All of a sudden, they love their mother and won't get out of her face. That's all I have to do. I have found the trick. But yeah, it really is stilling time and making the time, because writing is a priority for me. And that's not the same for everyone, and that's totally okay. For me, I choose to make the sacrifices, because I know balance is a myth.
Yeah. I believe that too. Yeah. Oh, that really resonates with me. Balance is a myth. I'm actually working on more balance. I know that I've overtaxed myself in the last few years, and I'm like, I really need a break, and I'm planning this big sabbatical, and it's like horrifying. I'm like more stressed taking a break than I would be about.
What do you mean you're going to have nothing to do? Oh my God. Fill it with something. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, it's true. So if you see me on Twitter just screaming, it's probably the current political environment plus.
Free time.
I have lost too much free time. Yeah. Well, shockingly, this hour has flown by despite all of our issues at the front. I can't believe that. So, will you tell everybody what your newest book is, or whatever book you want to talk about that's out, and how they can find that?
My newest book is Gridiron Bad Boy.
I just bought it.
It's about a football player who contractually agreed to be on his best behavior for a year, and then he meets the heroine, and everything goes to shit. But, you know, it ends in a happily ever after, so I think you'll love it. You can check it out.
I'm so excited right now. I have to hurry through the Scots to get to this. And then I have to read Geeks. Like, I can't. It's like an embarrassment of riches.
I honestly think you might. What's funny is that, I have found that people who love my Scott series, it's kind of a jolt for them to go into my Geeks. But the people who started with my Geeks and go into my Scots, they're always totally in love. And I wonder if it's the shift in darkness. So let me know.
That's interesting.
So let me know.
All right. Yeah, I will. No, that's really interesting, because that's a fascinating study and what the flow of how people read. I mean,
yes.
The flow of expectation.
Yes.
Is better.
Yes.
Well, I'll let you know. I'll fill you in. I'll tweet at you. It'll be fine. Well, I'm so, so glad that we got to do this today.
I am too. It was a great conversation.
Yes. Thank you so much.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.